Good afternoon. My name is Melissa Campanelli, and I'm the Editor-in-Chief of Retail Online Integration. Welcome to today's Retail Online Integration webinar, 5 Cross-Channel Retail Fraud Risks and How to Avoid Them, sponsored by LexisNexis. Make no mistake about it, consumer-facing fraud is alive and well in the retail arena today. Whether it's friendly fraud, credit or debit card fraud, identity fraud, mobile fraud, or retail crime, cross-channel retailers are at risk. But they can fight back. Join our speakers today, Tom Dunlea, Managing Director of Americas for the Merchant Risk Council, and Pete Paredes, Vice President of Loss Prevention for the Neiman Marcus Group, as they discuss key cross-channel retail fraud risks and how retailers can avoid them before it's too late. Before we get started today, let me point out a few tips on how to make the most of today's live presentation. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help button at the bottom of the console or let us know via the Ask a Question box. Second, make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can see and take part in any interactive portions of today's presentation. To get a PDF version of the slide presentation for future reference, click on the Download Slides button on the console. And if you're enjoying the webinar and would like to spread the word to your peers, you can send an email invitation directly from the console by clicking the Invite a Colleague button. You can also give us your feedback at any time during the hour by clicking the survey button. The survey will also be distributed at the end of today's live webinar. Today's speakers will be answering select questions live during the presentation. Use the Ask a Question feature on the console to submit your questions for consideration in advance at any time. If you leave the presentation at any time, you can access the entire webinar on demand for the next 90 days via the same audience link you used to watch the presentation today. After that, the webinar can be viewed from the Retail Online Integration website, www.retailonlineintegration.com/webinar. Finally, we encourage you to tweet about the webinar today. If you do, please use the hashtag ROIWebinar when doing so. Take it away, Tom.
Great. Thank you. And we're really pleased to be here to have an opportunity to talk about the Merchant Risk Council, talk about what Pete's doing at Neiman Marcus in regard to these cross-channel fraud issues, and also to engage in questions and answers with today's attendees. So thank you for joining us. So the MRC, we are a nonprofit organization. We've been around for 11 years. Individuals like Pete Paredes from Neiman Marcus have been members since the beginning. We've had a really strong contingent of some of the largest global online retailers and multi-channel retailers that you've worked with, that you've heard of, that you've shopped with. And ultimately, the Merchant Risk Council is successful in its work if consumers look at online and mobile commerce and multi-channel transactions as safer and more convenient. And ultimately, we exist to make e-commerce more profitable as well. How do we do this? We have basically 4 aspects of all of our programs. It involves getting individuals to know each other, which includes not just merchants meeting merchants, but also merchants understanding the players on the payment landscape for mobile, for multi-channel, for online. We hold conferences. We have 2 in the States. We have 2 in Europe now. We hold online sessions like this. This is a joint presentation with ROI and LexisNexis, but we do a couple a month through our own system. And then we hold 3 annual surveys focused on fraud, focused on payment security, payment operations, and then increasingly we're looking at payment acceptance, which is broadly global expansion, payment types, that sort of thing. And then ultimately the MRC conducts advocacy work, which we look at as constructive dialogue to improve the industry, oftentimes including the payment brands, including solution providers like LexisNexis, and, of course, including leadership from the merchant community. Who are the constituents of the Merchant Risk Council? Clearly, we aren't able to put all of the logos on this slide, and Pete very politely pointed out to me that I didn't include Neiman Marcus. Nothing personal, Pete. We have about 200 of the main e-commerce brands, representing about 800 individuals from those e-commerce companies, and multi-channel, of course. It may not be obvious that we work closely with law enforcement agencies to promote collaboration between private industry and retail. We're also active with the payment processors, and recently I've had credit card issuers become involved with the Merchant Risk Council, again, because they're interacting with the consumer in a similar way as the retailer. And if a consumer has a bad experience with a declined transaction, that's going to impact our ability to get them to come back and utilize e-commerce in the future. And it's best for the issuers and the retailers if they continue to see e-commerce and multi-channel transactions as convenient and safe. Now, one of the sources of information that we'll be utilizing for this presentation today is the 2010 study that LexisNexis commissioned in partnership with Javelin Strategy and Research. This was released in April, and it's data from 2010. This is the second annual research that LexisNexis has conducted on the true cost of fraud. We've enjoyed a partnership with LexisNexis on this research in that we've brought merchants to provide comments. They've interviewed some of our members as well as other point-of-sale retailers and consumers and financial institutions. And fortunately for us, we have Jim Rice, who is available during our question and answer session. If you have questions pertaining to the statistics or the methodology or anything specific to the research that Pete or I will not be able to answer. So we're glad to have Jim Rice available, and we'll call on him as needed at the end of the presentation. Now, this study is available to you if you go to lexisnexis.com/retail. It will take you to the landing page, and you can download this survey. There'll be a link sent in the follow-up email as well. It's chock full of amazing information. Some of the key stats I'll point out before we get into some of the statistics pertinent to fraud is that, you know, through their research, they saw about a 14% growth of U.S. Of folks in the U.S. utilizing online shopping. So that's pretty healthy, and it meets with other industry research that's been done. And that online purchases, online retail purchases, grew 18%. So again, these are healthy growth areas for us to think about as we're considering this discussion. Now, it was also brought, and I'm only showing select slides from this research. So again, go to their site to get the full package. But the payments continue to evolve, and this slide is particular to online purchases. And it's clear that credit cards are still king, hovering around 40% of all purchases online, debit at about 28%, and alternative payments roughly representing 20% of those online payments. The bottom line here is that there's huge opportunities for offline switching driven through these alternatives. Especially if you're a retailer that's trying to reach out to younger demographics, we're seeing a strong attraction to other payment methods other than traditional credit card or debit payment methods. Next slide here is really about, again, online merchants, and we'll do all merchants in a moment. But the credit card fraud continues to dominate, but that there is definitely an increase in the fraud that retailers are experiencing that's connected to alternative payment methods. So now the next information that we're going to look at is pertaining to all merchants. Again, the threats from online they're still in play, but if you start to include physical world purchases, then checks, of course, come into the mix, and they have a much larger percentage than you would see in any sort of online transaction at 26%. If you've been following the news at all, the United Kingdom is going to phase out paper checks by the year 2018. And this is still a main way that B2B transactions are made. But with the evolution of consumers' shopping behavior and electronic payments in the States, it's only a matter of time, I think, before the discussion about paper checks becomes more dominant in the U.S. So Pete and I are going to walk through five fraud trends and things that we think you should be aware of in your businesses. And we're going to walk through them. We're going to start with friendly fraud as an issue. I'll provide a definition for each of these, and then Pete's going to help us with some specifics and things that he's addressed at Neiman Marcus. Credit card fraud will be our second category. Identity fraud, third. Mobile fraud will be fourth. And then retail crime will be the last area that we address before we move on to a summary and then questions and answers. So I would just point out that our working definition of friendly fraud is where there's a dispute coming from a cardholder who either knows the fraudster or is the person themselves. Oftentimes they're disputing the delivery or the purchase because the retailer didn't ask for proof of delivery. Sometimes this is an issue around the relationship with the carrier, and we're excited at the MRC to have UPS and FedEx very involved with our efforts with the retailers, and are working on bringing DHL into the membership as well, because we need coordination and collaboration between retailers and the carriers, and then of course the card issuers when these issues of friendly fraud come up. And in looking at kind of the sophisticated retailers and this issue of friendly fraud, it's clear that you've got to track customer history. The size of the transaction is going to make a big difference. You know, a lot of our electronics shipping members have altered their methods with carriers to make sure they are getting a signature, so they're not shipping free laptops to people that are savvy to friendly fraud issues. And Pete, I wonder if maybe you want to talk a little bit about what you do at Neiman Marcus to, you know, detect and deter this type of fraud activity.
Certainly. First of all, good afternoon to everybody, and I thank everybody for joining the this webinar. From just as an overall statement, the approach here that we're taking is really from a multi-channel standpoint. Not going to cover every bit of it, but some of the high-level stuff, as Tom just outlined, and what we're seeing, and obviously multi-channel from a both from a merchant perspective and also from a risk and loss prevention perspective, is clearly the wave of where most of us are going, and that's the approach that we're trying to take. And the Merchant Risk Council is starting to really take a really heavy look into the risk piece and the security piece, and how that all kind of runs across all the channels from an e-tailer and a retailer traditional brick and mortar perspective. I'll start off by saying, you know, some of the things from a Neiman's perspective that we identify or we consider to be friendly fraud. To add to what Tom's definition was, is and to also digress for a minute and also say as a side note that we, like most people, most businesses, have seen an increase in this, in the friendly fraud arena, with the onset of the economy dipping and people trying to get something for nothing or taking advantage of the fact that, as Tom mentioned earlier, there isn't a proof of delivery and things of that nature. At Neiman's, we do see that. Proof of delivery is a big concern for us. We don't ship. Over 90% of the stuff that we ship does not have a proof of delivery or a signature required. That would add an extra expense, a rather large expense, to our shipping costs if we did that. So in those cases, where there isn't a proof of delivery and the cardholder, if you will, knows that, then they'll dispute it, and a lot of times we can't lose or we can't win that chargeback. We've seen an increase in carrier claims, with respect to claiming that they didn't receive it. It came damaged, and things of that nature. We also consider, you know, the returning of fake goods or counterfeit merchandise in place of the merchandise that we sent them, as part of that, in that friendly fraud bucket, and that's how we look at that. And we have a big, huge, gift with purchase business, where you come online or you go into stores and you buy your merchandise and gift with purchase and samples come with the purchase, and then subsequently those purchases, the actual merchandise that was purchased is returned, and the samples or the GWPs are kept. And, you know, one-offs are not the issue, but we do have, you know, certain rings and certain people out there that actually take advantage of that at a very large volume, and then we end up seeing our gift with purchases either being shipped overseas to be sold at a premium price or even internationally or in the U.S. on auction sites and things of that nature. So some of the things that we've done and we continue to do to start to develop some things that will help us with that, from both from a online and from a brick and mortar perspective, a true multi-channel perspective, is we try to include whenever we can to look at real time and post historic purchasing data and patterns. So we want to we take that, that those, if you have access to your order management system, your back end systems that actually accept the orders and move them through your process, and you and part of that database has history and patterns of purchasing. A lot of the marketing folks here have a lot of scripts that run in the background that combine households and things of that nature. We use that. We try to use that both in real time or historically when we're trying to dispute or rebut and try to protest, if you will, a chargeback when we represent it back to the car to our acquirer. So those are that's a big piece. Tracking the lifetime purchases and returns of customers, and looking at, you know, are there like purchases in the past? Did we ship to that same place in the past under perhaps a different name? We also look at customer return frequency, and if they reach a 85 or 90% return to lifetime return to lifetime sales ratio, then we actually reach out to the customers, that customer, and we let them know that we're obviously having issues trying to satisfy them with our merchandise, but we are going to take a more TLC approach with them, and any further issues we'll have to separate our business with them. Carrier claims, as Tom mentioned earlier, we take advantage of, we are a FedEx shop here, but UPS and the other big carriers also have like programs where you can take advantage of them. For instance, the FedEx One program that does not allow any shipment to be rerouted by the purchasing individual without Neiman's being involved. They would have to call an 800 number, and then FedEx calls us. We give out we look at it. We give out a password, and we allow or don't allow that rerouting. And there is some discussions in the background as to that this has happened. Work with our fraud vendor. We've worked with our fraud vendor and our fraud vendor solution providers. One of the things that we have that is being developed right now, we haven't put it in yet. I know some of us or most of us use some type of device ID or device print technology as part of our fraud detection and decisioning. We're taking that a step further, and we're creating an online affidavit form that we will send out to this person who is disputing a chargeback we believe is fraudulent, from a friendly fraud standpoint. And really, the form is very basic, but what we're really trying to glean is after the fact, when they submit the form back to us, we compare that ID print on that from that device with the ID print or the device print of the originating order, if you will, that is being disputed. And if there's a pattern there, if there's a commonality there, or if there's a match, we will work at it that way. I just wanted to kind of to hit home the point of what we're seeing from a friendly fraud standpoint. This is a case that happened this year. We got a dispute, if you from American Express, saying that a cardholder was disputing over $80,000 worth of transactions on his American Express card, and we were not obviously going to take that and just accept it. So our chargeback folks and our fraud folks worked together in the same room. They started to look into it, and really, in a nutshell, what turned out to be a dispute from this gentleman, who happened to be a lawyer as well, he claimed that he had a girlfriend or a female friend that he gave permission for her to purchase one time from us with his American Express card, and she then proceeded to purchase several times from us without his authorization. So the dispute came back as not authorized transactions. Well, we started looking into it. We did some research, as you can see in the first slide here. We were able to identify where the merchandise was going. We We reached out to her. We found her online through her Facebook and other online services. We contacted her. She started to give us information. And cross-referencing all that, you can see on the upper left there in that little quadrant, she had met this gentleman in a seekingarrangements.com site, which is basically a sugar daddy site, or that's how they advertise themselves, where people get on, females in this case, get on, they're looking for somebody, and they put a range of what that, what they're looking for with regards to, you know, what type of monthly, support they're looking for and monthly money that they want. So, we were looking at her, she then, supplied us with information, next slide, Tom, with information, as to, where this merchandise was going. She had purchased several items for her brother, which you see there on the upper center there. That's her brother next to her. And you can see that the brother is wearing things, and so is she, that we actually sold her. The brother was actually trying to take the merchandise, and on the far right there is his Craigslist listing of our merchandise that was purchased with these American Express card with this American Express account. She also furnished us with emails and text messages information and phone calls that she had received from this gentleman, where in more than one instance in the emails he was authorizing her to use his American Express card and even listed the card. So we put all that together. Our chargeback group worked very hard with American Express. We initially had presented it. We got declined. We escalated it to their fraud department and their supervisor. We re-represented our dispute or our challenge, and it was accepted at that point with all the evidence that we had gathered. So the lesson learned here is, you know, just be tenacious about that. Do a lot of research. And, you know, you put a good enough case together, and even though we've got certain agreements, and as e-tailers, we don't have a lot of the protection that brick and mortar might have when it comes to a chargeback, there are ways that you can win these things, and this was a big windfall for us because we were facing an $80,000 dispute, or a chargeback, rather.
Great. Ready to move on, Pete?
Yep.
Awesome. So next category for fraud awareness is around credit and debit card fraud. You know, it's estimated that still online fraud in the U.S. as a percentage is on the decline. Again, we're focused in online transactions here, and we know there's a blending between point of sale and online. But our research shows that MRC members are experiencing less than 1% of transactions becoming fraud. And although the percentage has been declining for each of the past 6 years, with our members' total online revenues growing, and therefore fraud losses have been increasing. Finally, in the last couple years, we've seen a drop also in fraud losses, but until 2008, they've been steadily climbing. And this has raised the awareness, as Pete mentioned, of various layered technology solutions that retailers can implement, device recognition, utilizing services like what LexisNexis offers or other solution providers to help them identify these fraudulent transactions. And going back to a couple of the comments Pete made in the friendly fraud area, we're hearing a lot from retailers about clean fraud, especially as a result of the data breaches that have happened recently in the industry. There's a lot of fraud that's coming through that's tougher to detect and has really been testing the limits of their fraud solutions that they've implemented. And again, if you go and you look at LexisNexis's recent research, there's an estimate there that retailers lost in the states lost over $191 billion U.S. dollars in fraud losses. And again, this is both point of sale, online, multi-channel combined. And I think, and Pete, you know, you have your own experiences, but what we're seeing in the industry is that the big online retailers are becoming more sophisticated, and ultimately what's happening is a lot of the fraudulent activity is being pushed out to smaller or mid-tier retailers, and that they're the companies that need to become more sophisticated because that's where the nefarious activity is happening. So, Pete, you want to say a few words about your observations around organized crime and gift cards and the reshipping programs, and then, you know, what retailers might do with their shipping partners?
Sure. What we're seeing as well with the organized crime is they're leveraging, you know, the fact that we as retailers and specifically are going multi-channel, so they're kind of balancing their load, if you will, and they will victimize you online. For instance, purchasing something, a gift card online, and then coming directly back to your brick and mortar establishment and using that gift card there. So it's important that your systems start to talk to each other, that your risk folks are talking to each other, that you have a database where exception reporting, you're gathering aggregate data from all your systems across all your channels and bringing it into one centralized location, and basically gleaning exceptions from that to see transactions and to see individuals, if you will, across the entire enterprise, not just in a siloed fashion as we may have been doing in the past, by looking at them based on within a specific channel. So we see that. We see people coming online and using stolen credit cards, and as Tom mentioned, clean fraud, where it's very hard to detect. And those, again, we use our systems to look at buying patterns, click transaction data. If your websites are recording click transactions, that's a good platform to use. I've coined it WebTiVo, that you can actually use either real time or after the fact to kind of determine whether this person's behavior as you're watching them click through their session is indicative of potentially fraud or not. Protecting gift cards at POS, we've had a lot of issues at POS with respect to that, and in the past, and the Merchant Risk Council, along with the NRF, has done a lot to communicate or to educate the risk and the loss prevention community as to how you can better protect your gift cards at your terminals, at kiosks, making sure that CIN numbers and algorithms are being used, and that those numbers are being protected, and that if those numbers are compromised on the card, that the card should be voided out and not sold or loaded, because we've had people that will go on to an IVR and bang at that all day waiting for that particular gift card to load, and once it does, they use it online or in a store. So we see a lot of that, and there's certain, again, leveraging your systems to identify that or when it happens and be able to react to it, and it's extremely important and paramount that in a multi-channel environment you have that communication path within your risk teams, whether they are physically siloed. Doesn't necessarily have to mean that the walls have to stay up with regards to communicating to each other and sharing that data, if you will. We leverage whatever programs that our carriers offer to combat reshipping fraud. From a reshipping standpoint, we look at, you know, velocities and historical data that goes out there, ensuring that we identify anybody that is part of our review process. If we do ask the right question that solicits the proper response, you can pick out whether that is that person who is reshipping either willingly or unwittingly, and identify that particular individual within your system so that if they come across again in any of the data sets that you're monitoring, that they're identified and flagged as such.
Good. Okay. Thanks, Pete. Let's move on to our third area then. And just a reminder to those of you who are attending, I'm flipping through the attendee list, and I see some quite prominent multi-channel brands in our attendee list today. So, you know, Melissa is standing by, ready for questions that you might have. But Pete and I, we're also good sports. So if you're sitting out there and you disagree with anything we are saying, or you have any additional comments, please feed them to Melissa, and I think that will enrich the conversation when we get to the Q&A section. Next, we're going to address identity fraud. You know, generally these are referred to as account takeovers. You know, transactions that appear to be legitimate and oftentimes are initiated with a newly issued or reissued card. Sometimes there's a change of address that takes place on a consumer's account with the retailer. Criminal oftentimes is in essence has control over that person's identity. Again, deterrence comes through layered fraud prevention approaches, detecting aberrant shopping behavior, frequency checks, you know, the velocity and the orders. You know, this where Pete and I have talked over the years about the need for increased communications with the issuers. If there's a change in the account with the issuer of the credit card, sometimes retailers are aware of this, and increased communications could help us all avoid more fraud. And before I turn it over to Pete to talk about Neiman Marcus and their efforts in the realm of detecting and deterring identity fraud, I would just share with you the conversation that I have with my wife on a regular basis. And it centers on this paradox around privacy that consumers are looking for and yet generally are offering up so much personal information online that it's making it easier for their identities to be taken, easier for retailers, clearly, based on the case study that Pete just provided, for retailers to do research on consumers who might be performing transactions that are questionable. But the running joke I have with my wife is that no one under 30 is ever going to be able to run for elected office in the United States based on their behaviors online. And it's a small tangent, but you know, it's relevant to this topic that well-meaning elected officials are proposing legislation, and it's being titled Do Not Track, that's similar to Do Not Call legislation. And, you know, this is really stemming from consumers complaining about having their behavior tracked online, when in fact they're agreeing to this sort of monitoring, but with the terms and conditions, and they're encouraging it. You know, online retailers like Amazon, they generate a lot of sales because of the relationship they have with consumers and the information they have on consumers. So just a couple general industry observations and trends. Now, Pete, you want to talk a little bit about your specific efforts in identity fraud prevention and detection?
Sure. I mean, we're not unique in being victimized with identity fraud. I mean, it's very hard to detect, as you mentioned, and we all know in these particular instances, the fraudster is coming to us with all the information at hand, issued a credit card and an account number from the bank. So we also have a very tough time identifying that. And again, it kind of goes back to this layered approach, making sure that both your risk models on the online side are tweaked all the time, consistently to identify any patterns that you're seeing, whether it be a BIN range of credit card numbers that you're being victimized, a particular issuing bank, things of that nature. On the POS side, we do a lot of training. And with our associates to ensure that they're not being manipulated, and to try to detect some of that identity fraud at the point of sale. We have an in-house account cards that we issue through a shared HSBC relationship, and so we have applications and actual identity fraud that we try to detect during the application process. We use verification questions both online and over the phone to add a layer to that credibility or to the validity of the person that's presenting the information, so that we open up that account with the best information we have. We limit our accounts. And then the open to buy limits, so that we're in the event that one does slip through, it doesn't completely clean us out. So we use a lot of that. And again, going back to what I said earlier, the shared negative and positive databases that a lot of us have that are residing in our online fraud systems need to kind of expand out to across the enterprise, so that the brick and mortar side of the business is also leveraging that and trying to identify that. Anomalies in the shopping behavior, again, with identity theft, the best thing that you can do is look at that behavior. If you have web analytics that are available to you that you can actually put into your decisioning stream, and look at that. How did the customer come to your site? Did they land directly onto a product page, order 50 items, and then just leave and check out? Did they come in through a targeted email campaign that you sent to them so you know the customer? Or did they come in and were throughout the session, the shopping session, were they taking things in and out of their cart, or were they just putting things in, you know, indiscriminately? So a lot of the lessons that we've learned on the brick and mortar side as far as behavior is concerned that we had identified in the past historically, we try to take those behaviors and look at them or try to mimic looking at them on our websites as well. And then just acceptance at POS. To make sure that associates are following the proper procedures, the acceptance procedures, getting signatures on signature slips, matching them up, and swiping the card as opposed to keying the card, and then online, having the right type of algorithms on the front end to make sure that, you know, somebody can't be just banging away at your submit page, with credit cards and if you're real-time authorization. Platforms that just test cards, and once they find a card that authorizes, then that comes through. So we a lot of those things you have to kind of bring together, and we've tried to, and we continue to do that to combat probably the most difficult fraud to detect.
Hey Pete, we have a question and a comment that have come in, both coming from well-known multi-channel retailers. So first, the question for you: a few minutes ago, you mentioned a TiVo ability for
yes.
web transactions.
Huh?
Is that a product you purchased, or is that something you built in-house?
It's a product we purchased. There, and you know, I'm reluctant to mention any products here, but there are products out there. One of them is probably either best in class or at least the kind of the front runner, that and we use that product, and it sits behind our servers or behind our firewall, and it is not an API service. We host it here, and it collects all. It just clicks and collects every click through by session. If the session is fragmented, it will bring the session together. We've put some fundamental things on the front end, some alerts that behaviors that we want to see. You can actually do that. You can go and write if and statements, and or if you're looking even for a specific IP address, if a specific IP when that IP address connects with your server and creates a session, it'll alert you via an email or a specific application. A specific account number. For instance, if we know that because somebody has fraudulently opened up a Neiman Marcus account, we can flag that account on the back end and then put that account number into the system. And the minute we see that account number attempt to be used, it'll send a notification out that says, you know, this person's online right now. So that's the type of platform that we use.
That's great. There were a couple more comments from retailers, and I think we're gonna hold off on those and stick with the content and keep moving into our, if you're ready, Pete, move into mobile fraud.
Okay.
Okay, and hopefully we'll have time to come back to the two comments that we've heard so far. Okay, so moving on to our next section around mobile fraud, I think Pete and I would both be very honest with you in saying this is going to be the skimpiest section. It's the newest issue that retailers are tackling. The LexisNexis research found that many large retailers have seen an increase in mobile fraud in 2010. You know, it's also obvious that device recognition services or geolocation is not currently used by retailers on all mobile transactions, but it's predicted that it will be utilized for all of them, and that the current bevy of tools that are utilized by retailers for online transactions would be exactly similar for mobile. I have a couple slides here that just articulate kind of some of the press that's been happening. You know, the issues with that companies like Square, which are really promoting the use of mobile technology for payments by small business, consumer-to-consumer transactions. Square has grown wildly, and again, I'm not promoting any product, but, you know, I was at a security summit a couple months ago. Pete and I actually were both there, And Square's product isn't yet encrypted. So, I mean, it's grown wildly and yet perhaps doesn't have the level of security that it should have to ensure the safety that all of us want to have in the payment landscape. There was another brief article that we were reading, and that it's talking about really that an internet retailer, of course, is going to be a very strong proponent for the growth of e-commerce. So we have to take the source with a grain of salt. But it's saying it's not stealing, mobile commerce is not stealing business from the web. It's actually, you know, augmenting it. And that's exciting because, you know, we want to have mobile be a new form of transactions rather than cannibalizing existing. Pete, you want to spend a couple minutes hold on a moment here. Get to the right slide. A couple minutes and talk about some of the mobile issues that you guys are taking on at Neiman Marcus.
Sure. I think from Neiman's perspective, and probably for a lot of us, if you haven't done that, you're going into it as we are. Mobile fraud and the mobile kind of platform is also really the driver for a lot of this cross channeling. And from a marketing standpoint and from a merchant standpoint, to reach out to the customer and really bring the customer to, you know, a unified kind of an approach to one's business. So we are looking at mobile fraud to the extent that we're trying to identify how we're going to combat that. And first and foremost, we're pushing out mobile devices like a lot of us are doing. And it's very important, what we're finding as far as lessons learned is it's very important that, you know, a lot of these mobile devices, especially the most popular one, or one of the most popular ones, a lot of them are not enterprise-specific devices. They're end-user devices. So we're finding it very difficult to kind of control that. So one of the things that we're doing is we've gone out and we've found a mobile demand management platform that allows us to push policies to the mobile device so that it does not open up and risk us to the extent that we're communicating or have a potential of exposing either proprietary data, PCI information, PII data, things of that nature. So, and we've developed a group that is actually managing those policies internally, and it's a very high-level group so that the policies are taken at face value, and there is no pushback. So we believe very heavily in that really to combat this fraud. It's to kind of design it right up front. One of the things that we're also going to have to be battling with identifying mobile fraud is today, for instance, our online detection tools, fraud detection tools, as I mentioned earlier, we use device ID prints and things of that nature and look for velocities and frequencies from a device perspective. Well, if you're going to be pushing out all these mobile devices to your selling associates, say out in your brick and mortar establishments, or you're going to have applications that you're pushing out, apps that you're pushing out, selling apps that you're pushing out to your consumers, and they're going to come in and either use them on site or use them off-site, how do you distinguish between the velocity and the frequency of a mobile device that's coming in from an associate using one of your mobile devices versus the frequency from a consumer? And being able to differentiate that, otherwise you're going to have a lot of false positives, in my opinion, and you're going to be really chasing your tail trying to figure that out on the back end as these orders are triggering these algorithms and these scoring models, and they're outsorting these orders for manual review. So there's going to have to be a call for a very healthy balance there. And again, it's all about kind of preparing and identifying the potential up front. We're very much involved in all of our mobile initiatives and our social media initiatives, and how we're going to push that out. And we equate that kind of in the same bucket. And we use a lot of fraud layering tools, and we monitor social media when we can externally, that from external sources, so that we can identify either somebody who is trying to defraud us externally or even internally. to identify any kind of patterns or initiatives, if you will, internally or externally that are plotting to victimize us from a fraudulent perspective. Building applications internally, it's important that PCI and PII is at the forefront of that. And so we're still learning a lot about that, and we're still trying to figure it all out. But those are some of the things that we're doing.
Great, Pete. I'm watching the time here. We probably should spend maybe 4 minutes or so on the retail crime, and then move into our summary.
Okay.
For those of you that aren't aware of, you know, one of the most advertised organized crime, retail crime groups that's been active, you should check out the article written by James Verini in the New York Times Magazine, November 2010. It was called The Great Cyber Heist. And it highlights Albert Gonzalez's role at the Shadow Crew, gleaning a lot of their information from point-of-sale systems. I think a lot of consumers thought that they were getting information through e-commerce. The reality is they were applying the information they harvested about consumers from sniffers in the parking lots of point-of-sale stores. Then they're using it online for purchases. You know, and they were able to, it was untold millions that they were able to steal with these methodologies. And if you just look at one of the victims, Heartland Payments, they ended up spending over $400 million just in reimbursements and forensic and legal fees because of the work that Shadow Crew did. So I think the point here is the level of organization and this type of theft is unparalleled, and we're not even sure of, you know, just exactly how many other gangs like this are still operating, but it was a great tribute to private industry collaboration with law enforcement, specifically Department of Justice, to bring down Shadow Crew. So, Pete, you know, what are you seeing in regard to retail crime?
Well, retail crime, what we're seeing is the bleeding over. We're seeing some commonality between, you know, individuals or groups of individuals, organized crime rings, like you just mentioned, that typically we're victimizing our brick-and-mortar establishments. We're seeing those individuals and those data sets popping up on our online as well. A lot of them are take a very specific approach in understanding your business and some of the frontline prevention procedures and policies that you put in place, both in brick and mortar and then the technology you're trying to use to detect that on the back end online, and compromise it or socially engineer around it. So some of the things that, you know, that we've been seeing very recently is a phenomenon that we've been seeing is people are calling into our brick and mortar establishments with gift cards that have been purchased either online or in the retail stores, and impersonating and knowing the names of key people in those facilities, in those store environments, and over the phone being able to convince and coerce associates to load gift cards with value. In these cases, identify themselves as loss prevention people that work in that particular facility. So, you know, there's been a huge communication and training campaign from us to let associates know that they are not to identify or they're not to process any kind of a financial transaction of that type, simply because they're getting a phone call over the phone, on the phone. So, you know, it's a lot of communication, a lot of awareness that we're building in. We're also seeing, you know, instances where, you know, they know the type of things that we're doing as retailers or e-tailers rather to identify, online fraud with regards to the systems and the fraud stuff and the surveys that are being published in the web and the device IDing and all that. So we're seeing some of that stuff migrate into, you know, reverting back to people calling in their orders either on the phone or via a live chat. They're chatting with our agents, and then they just say, go ahead and order it for me, and they're essentially ordering it through a live chat. So we're trying to figure out ways to identify that and how do we get that into our decisioning stream. Shipping from more than one store and with a calling campaign with stolen credit cards, we are in the process of an initiative where we're going to be using what we know and what we've learned over the last 10 years as e-tailers and putting and leveraging our fraud decisioning platforms on the e-tailer side to combat and identify some of the fraud on the brick-and-mortar side. And in these instances, in these cases, we're going to be taking our shipments that we're shipping directly. These are purchases that are being made from the store but are being shipped to a location. Those that transactional data will come in through our decisioning tools, our online decisioning tools, to better assess and leverage some of the things that we were able to do to identify fraud that way.
Nicely done. So let's do a quick summary, if you're okay with that, Pete.
Absolutely.
Move into Q&A. Okay. So Pete just exemplified the need for cross-channel communications. He also multiple times talked about how departments need to communicate with each other. You know, Neiman Marcus is a very customer service-oriented entity, which is fantastic. It's how they built the reputation. But then the fraud guys have got to be able to put their stamp on how customer interactions happen, because it has to be a part of their consciousness. Opportunities like this, or being a part of the MRC, looking at the list of attendees today, we've got a good percentage of you that are already members. The rest of you might consider it. It's a way to stay on top of industry trends, the best practices that Pete's sharing. Obviously, you know, there are technologies we didn't mention today, specific vendors, specific solutions. There is a lot of good information out there. MRC members know about it. Other calls like this are going to help you learn about what's going on. And then for your specific company, finding the right layered approach, how to use these things in combination, how to make sure that your defense mechanisms are as good as possible without turning away too many good transactions as well. So, Melissa, I see we've got a fair number of questions here. I wonder if you...
I was going to say, I mean, I could ask them, or maybe there's a couple that jump out that you think maybe, you know, you'd like to tackle, or...
Yeah, absolutely. And Pete, are you able to see the list as well?
I am, yes.
Okay.
One of the questions that I guess I can answer is, basically how many resources, or what type of resources do we here have to within our fraud or risk groups? We have approximately, for our entire enterprise, we have approximately 12 fraud investigators, and with a management layer of four, but we also leverage our online chargeback group as well. So we've cross-trained them so that we can flex them in and out as we need. So collectively, with the flexing, we probably have somewhere between 14 and 15 people that can at any given time be in and identifying and reviewing some of these fraud orders.
Okay, let's move on to the next question we have in regard to international orders, Pete.
Uh-huh.
I know this is a relatively recent development for Neiman Marcus, but you do ship internationally.
Yes, we do.
What are you seeing internally as far as the percentage of fraud that's taking place with international orders?
Well, what I can tell you is that we're just like and a lot of the surveys, the two surveys that you've alluded to, reflect the same thing. Because of the difficulty in getting any kind of AVS, consistent AVS on the credit card, on the accounts, and on the back end, being able to research that and make calls and reach out to people and identify, you know, the typical things that we do nationally here or in the U.S., we have seen our international chargebacks are higher than our domestic chargebacks, if you will. And it is a challenge, and it's a continued challenge. One of our biggest geolocations, our fraud locations, is the U.K.
Good. And James Rice, do you have any information from your experience with LexisNexis in regard to international transactions, or perhaps a source for this retailer to go find out more?
Yeah, this is Jim Rice with LexisNexis. Thanks, Tom. Just a couple quick comments. I think we're finding from our customer base that they are definitely experiencing higher rates of fraud in the international channel. For the reasons that have been mentioned, it's just, you know, harder in terms of the data that's available to do address checking or identity checking, identity verification. There are some solutions out there that help address that, so I would encourage any retailers that are faced with the international issue to kind of check out what is currently in the market. That's an area that I know a lot of vendors are continuing to look at to expand their capabilities. In terms of research, it's actually very interesting because we're in the process of doing our next version of the LexisNexis True Cost of Fraud study. And within that study, we're adding a special section on international fraud. So I would just encourage any retailers on this call to look for that study. It'll be coming out in the September-October timeframe. And we'll be addressing that specific question of what is the experience of international fraud, what are retailers experiencing in terms of that, and what solutions they're trying to look forward to help address that. So I would simply say that you can look at that. Obviously, there's a study that MRC puts out every year that also touch base on international and the experience of retailers in terms of their fraud rates for international products versus domestic products as well.
That's great. Thanks, Jim. Hey, Pete, a couple specific questions for you as a retailer in regard to one is what you do when you determine clean credit card fraud or specifically ID takeover, that sort of thing. And the question, and I'll paraphrase it to shorten it, but what's the best integrated way to protect against clean credit card fraud? And if that happens, where do you report it?
Well, with respect to where do you report it, if it's something where we're seeing a particular ring or a particular velocity of either a fraudster or an account number or a BIN range, we'll report that to the issuing bank. But we do file IC3 with the IC3. We do file those issues with them, and the IC3 does collect those and tries to work. Try to work them more in a more broad collective fashion. So, with respect to how we're combating it, again, it's those approaches that I was talking about. It's that layered approach. What we see here, the first time somebody will probably come in and probably get away with it, but it's really being able to identify it on the back end, making sure that your communication, your systems are quick enough so that you can identify these things within your system so that subsequent activity is identified very quickly. A lot of retailers are using 3D verification, like verified by Visa and SecureCode, as part of protection, if you will. But again, from a clean fraud perspective, sometimes that doesn't always help.